This is Geek Speak, episode 13 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam.
Hello.
You're a software engineer and political junkie, or so I'm told.
Yes, I am.
What have you been working on lately? Because you're not working. You're working on the side project.
I'm working on Geek Speak stuff.
Awesome.
Which I get paid so well for.
It's like
all I got a 100% raise last year.
Every minute you get 100%. Compound interest, man. 0%. It's amazing. Let's talk about something that we didn't talk about last week, which I wanted to, and I don't know why we skipped it.
Yeah, it just fell through the cracks.
You ever played any Sims games, Miles?
Yes, I have.
What kind of Sims games have you played?
I played the original SimCity.
Can you describe, because I've never played a Sims game, I mean, I know what they are kind of, but can you describe how they work?
You have a board, and you put in whatever items may be pertinent to that game. So, for example, SimCity, you're putting in buildings and parks and bridges and roads. And in the case of SimCity, people will start to occupy that. And depending upon if you add a whole bunch of roads, then you start ending up with pollution problems, especially if you don't have enough parks, and then you need to put in public transit. But then,
what's the goal? To make it efficient?
Yeah, to make the best city.
But what defines the best city? Like the population density, things like that?
Sure. How big your city is and how ecologically efficient it is and how happy your citizens are.
So you have like little meters representing all those things?
Yes.
And if you put in lots of parks, they get happy, but then they get lazy and the GDP isn't as good. I mean, like, what's failure besides like pollution?
What's failure? I mean, because you'll have people will start complaining and get angry with you. And you'll also have major traffic jams, so then your economic activity drops.
I don't get the joy of that. Was it fun?
Yeah, it was interesting.
All right.
Some people don't get the joy of looking at random characters on a screen that make things happen on a website.
I wouldn't say they're random. If they were random, they wouldn't make things work very well.
Oh, well, the changes you make in SimCity were not random either.
You're the one that used random, not me. All right, what about Roller Coaster Tycoon? It's the same type of thing, right?
Yes. You're able to make, you know, your favorite roller coaster, like a simulation of it, or just make something that could not possibly exist. People have made roller coasters where, like, it sends the car up, and then there's just open air, and it has to land correctly on a track. The ones that we would never want to have in real life.
But, so the art of this is kind of pixelated, and it's isomorphic in nature. So you're looking at like a 3D forced perspective kind of look.
Yeah, some of them look better than others, but yeah.
And so with Tycoon, you're doing the same type of thing as the SimCity. You're just kind of building roller coasters that people have fun with, and they have to be like successful because people come back and such.
Yeah.
So you're basically competing with a simple AI that likes to ride roller coasters.
Right.
Am I just a grumpy old man now? That happens this year?
Apparently.
I grew a beard, turned 42, and now I'm a grumpy old man.
Well, see, the thing is, maybe there was a person on the website 8chan who was also a grumpy old man because he had this game and went, you know what? I'm going to make the longest, most hellish game possible.
Roller coaster. Okay.
Roller coaster. So he took the largest board possible and then filled it with tracks. But the thing is, when the car starts off, it gets a little boost at the beginning and you can have it, you know, go up to the top of a hill, for example. In this case, it doesn't go up top of a hill. The car just goes at a certain speed and he tells it to hit the brakes. Funny thing about this game, it never actually coasts to a stop.
Okay, it so goes, there's a thing that slows it down. So it's,
yeah, you
it's
can hit the brakes so it goes to like 4 miles an hour.
But it's a mathematical program, so you don't have to have it friction actually win.
And then it just gets progressively slower and slower, but never actually hits zero.
Okay, so first off, you described a game I'm not even sure is fun to play. Now you're talking about making something that goes, a roller coaster that goes really slow. Please tell me the story here.
So in the end, Okay, I'm sorry. If you were to actually play this roller coaster out.
Okay, if you were one of the characters in
this roller coaster that's named Kairos the Slow.
Okay.
It would theoretically, assuming you sat for it, 210 real life days to finish.
It would take almost a year.
Two-thirds of a year, yeah.
Two-thirds of a year.
Now, the in game, okay, time grows faster than it does outside the game.
Oh, so
it would take 3,000 years for the person to finish riding the coaster.
Wait, does the tycoon understand the AI characters would die and like skeletons happen after?
I don't know, actually.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the people that get stuck on a ship that only gets awakened every 10,000 years for people to get force fed. Okay, that's
now the
funny
thing is, someone made a roller coaster called the Wheel of Life and Death a while ago. That was a variation of this theme. It wasn't as bad
210
as Kairos the Slow. But there's a video of the Wheel of Life and Death. So if you want to see what one of these coasters is like.
You know, Miles, while you're unemployed, what you should do is play this game on Twitch. You should stream yourself playing this 210 just like video of your face.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no.
Okay, so the other one, the Wheel of Death. Wheel of Death? Wheel of Life.
Wheel of Life and Death.
Wheel of Life and Death. It's a little faster?
Well, it's yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it also takes up less space.
Yeah.
And
virtual space.
Virtual space, yes. Okay. And the video does come with some creepy music, so it's good. And it doesn't do the entire roller coaster. It just does the very beginning. You get a sense for where it's going.
If it slows down, and pretty relatively soon, you won't even see it moving. I mean, if it's going to take 210 days for it to go around the track, a day of it, you won't even see.
Oh, I left one part out. It doesn't actually go all the way around. It goes all the way in a spiral to the center, and then it rolls back into a spiral again until it gets
backwards
back to the station.
Because it bumps into the end? He doesn't know that this happens. It might crash before that happens. It might not be 210 days. All right, anyway, Roller Coaster Tycoon. Gosh, you know, if you're... Okay, my wife was actually also addicted to sim games. I never saw the interest, but then again, I never played them. And since I know so many people that like them, I don't want to play them because I don't want to spend my time doing that. But let me know.
I actually thought the SimCity would do well as an educational platform to teach people what the back and forth of, you know, possibilities. If you do this, what are the drawbacks? What are the...
As you described it, that's what I was thinking. I was like, oh, wow, you'd actually, especially for a younger person, someone in their teens, understanding how a city has to be designed, has to work and function.
Yeah, it's not complex enough that a city planner would actually do it. But if you just wanted a basic understanding, and especially for kids, it's great.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. Let's talk about computers because we're both programmers. Tell me about names that break, would you, sir?
Yes, you see, some people have names that are fairly easy for a computer to handle. I mean, in the U.S.
Like Miles Elam. Not a bad name. It won't confuse you with distance.
Yeah, it's 5 letters for the first name, 5 letters for my middle name, 4 letters.
Your middle name's a little weird, but we won't get into that.
4 letters for the last name. And so I don't really break any systems. It's not really a problem.
I have a colleague at work whose last name I think has 60 something characters in it. And
that's impressive.
Yeah, it's impressive. And it is problematic on forms. But
60
on.
Characters for just
I think,
for the whole name or
well,
for...
it's an area name and family
right,
name
right,
kind
right,
of thing, right?
Right.
So it kind of represents a context.
He's South Indian, right?
She is, yes.
She is, yeah, okay, yeah. So, yeah, these are the experiences of people that, you know, when people are making websites and saying, put your name in,
mm-hmm.
You make certain assumptions, at least, you know, in most countries, the people that are there make certain assumptions, like that a name will only take this much space in the database.
Yes.
You know, we're going, no one would possibly have a name this long. And there's also other things like, you know, the expectation that someone's going to have a first and a last name.
Right. Not always true.
And for that matter, there are some people out there in the world who don't have what we would describe as a name.
Right. I mean, name complexity gets really quite complex because you sometimes, of course, in some cultures have name order different than you'd expect. Mm-hmm. Proper names are first, so on. But, I mean, surnames, if you will. There's a lot of complexity in them. In fact, so much so that when you're a programmer and someone asks you to handle names, you've got to go get a library to deal with that.
Yes. Yeah. Now, one person who's had a real hard time of it goes by the name of Jennifer Null.
Her last name is Null, as yes. in N-U-L-L?
That's right.
That's awesome. Okay, so I don't know why it would fail a lot, but you know from databases. But specifically in computer terminology, you have strings, which are like
or names. C-based languages.
Yeah, C-based languages. You have things like strings, like names and words, right? Those things, we call them strings, and they represent strings of characters. But basically, any text you ever read, that's considered a string. But you also have numbers, like 1, 2, 3, and they are thought of as differently in the computer system. And there's other types as well, like Boolean, which is basically yes or no. And that type is a certain type for variables and such. Another type, if you will, is null, which represents the absence of something. And in computer terminology, it's very useful to actually have null, because you can check to see if something exists or not by seeing if it is null.
Well, functional programmers out there will go like, no, it's completely useless, but we're going to ignore them for now.
The dialogue on this could go deep and crazy. We won't get into that. But suffice it to say that the string, the characters N-U-L-L, with the right context, means something really bad from
well,
the perspective
just,
of having data.
Yeah.
It represents the lack of data. So what happens to her when she puts in her name in a form?
Well, apparently she was working as an on-call substitute teacher, and they would get notified through, for example, an online service. And the website wouldn't work because whenever she tried to
use it, it
would say, you need to enter your last name. I did put in my last name. But the system was coded so that it would convert everything to a string.
And then compare.
And so lazy programmers will just go like, oh, well, null is coming in as a string. I'll just compare against null and I'll be covered.
And she looked like basically there was nothing into the field.
Right.
Awesome. Awesome. How do you deal with that? Like, you go to other sites?
I guess
you could start putting in characters. You could make your name N space U space L space L. Right? Because then at least a human saw it, they'd be like, oh, I know who that is. That's Jennifer.
Except that many sites will then do a thing like there can't be any spaces in there.
Oh,
it has to be.
How about null?
I guess you could have an N-U-L-L. Because a lot of
hyphen names. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but there are some sites that don't take hyphenated names.
Yeah. Programmers are stupid.
And in fact, it's not limited to the U.S. and that type of thing. There's also things like in Japan, an individual, Patrick McKenzie. Doesn't seem so hard, right? Except he lives in Japan, where most characters are kanji or katakana. Mm-hmm. And so printed forms, 8 characters is too many.
Oh.
4 characters in a Japanese name is very rare.
I see, and 8 would be way too long. I see, yeah. So, do you recall the Exploits of a Mom, XKCD, article? It's episode 327. XKCD
yes.
is a comic book that we've mentioned many, many times on online comic book, xkcd.com. If you understand most of what we talk about on the show, you will love this comic book. If you're a little lost, you can go look at it and then ask us to explain stuff, and we'd be happy to do that. We're geeks at
because jokes are always funnier when you explain them.
So, you know, geeks love explaining jokes. I would love to do an entire episode where we just had somebody come in and go, what does this mean?
Hey Lyle, why do you geeks get Halloween and Christmas mixed up?
Because Oct 31 equals Deck 25.
Yeah.
I've explained that on former episodes of Geek Speaks, but we won't get into that here. But recently, I started listening to, and maybe I mentioned this to you or somebody else, I started listening to Reply All podcast. Okay, Reply All, really funny podcast. One of these things they do is called Yes, Yes, No, or Yes, Yes, No. And it's basically these two hosts, and the person comes on, and they read a tweet that they don't understand. And then the two hosts try to explain what the tweet is. And I found it captivating.
Did you hear about the geek that took a shower?
No.
Looked at the shampoo, wash, rinse, repeat.
Oh, no, he died.
And he died.
Except that you'd run out of the soap, so he wouldn't die. Okay. XKCD article, though, is... Should I describe it or should I just let it go? We'll link to it from our site.
We'll link to it from the
site. It's number 327 of XKCD, and it's little Bobby tape, little Bobby drop tables. But anyway. You got any other names that don't work in forums on the internets?
Yes, there is a woman who's from Hawaii whose surname is 36 characters long, which tends to be a problem for many sites.
Many
the state ID doesn't handle that.
What do you do when your characters are so long? Like, what do? You just try
to abbreviate it in many cases.
Hope there's not a collision.
Well, the problem isn't so much a collision. It's more to do, I think, with the fact that their driver's license will say one thing and then some other identifier will say another thing. And, maybe one shortened form is different than another shortened form because one thing allows for 10 characters and another one allows for 12.
So, you know what zero rating plans are with regard to your cell phone carriers?
So, a new story, yes.
Yeah, we're moving on. Is that cool?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, cool. So, what do you use? AT&T, Verizon?
AT&T.
Something else? Okay. I use AT&T as well. But in any case, I found actually Verizon doesn't work here at my house. Where I live. Well, we're recording at my house today. Whatever. So, Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, T-Mobile all have started implementing these zero rating systems. And basically they mean what happens here is you normally have a cap on your data. And that means that if you use too much data, they charge you more and it's really quite expensive.
Yes. And the faster your plan is, the faster you fill up that cap as opposed to, for example, making the cap bigger.
That's the thing that is a little frustrating. The better speeds you get, just the faster you use it up. And
I see what you did there. Little frustrating. Yeah. So anyway,
these plans, the issues with them has to do with the kind of when these carriers provide this service of saying, hey, if you use these types of services, we won't charge your data cap. A perfect example of this would be Comcast having a video service on their website, and you are using Comcast and you use their video service, you can watch as much of that as you want. It doesn't count against your plan. But if you then go start watching YouTube and Netflix and Facebook videos, you'll run into caps quicker. And so it kind of preferentially treats their service as better for you as a consumer. And this is kind of anti the net neutrality ideal.
Mm-hmm. From a technical standpoint, it can make sense because you're already on Comcast Network, for example,
or AT&T Networks.
And so they don't have to pay for the networking trunk to the backbone to talk to other services. But it also means that you're conflating two things that are under the umbrella of, say, Comcast or AT&T or Verizon, of their data services of just shuttling data back and forth and their media services. And that's where it comes into a sticky situation with regard to competition, that it's not just, apples and oranges. It's apples in the entire fruit basket bundled together and making oranges sit out in the cold.
So there's other examples of this where AT&T, for example, has 10 companies actually paying them not to charge the consumer the data plan. So does that make sense to you?
Yep.
Did I say that right? I'm trying to find the list of different companies. But basically, AT&T sponsored data consumers, according Fierce Wireless, Aquato, Liberty Mutual, and a few more, they focus on sponsoring the content. So that company sponsors some video content, adds ads to it, basically. And then that whole content experience is not billed to your data plan on AT&T. It's free for you. But of course, AT&T is collecting money from those consumers, and therefore your data rate plan is not so good. Now, these actually kind of feel right to a consumer because, of course, then you get a lot more content without being charged for it. Another example of this is T-Mobile. They exempt some music services and some video services. They're calling their system Binge On. And these, of course, are ways for the company to advertise to you as the consumer that it's maybe a better experience for you. Well, in any case, there's an open letter by a whole bunch of companies, 50 advocacy groups, asking the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, to stop the zero rating systems implemented by Comcast, AT&T, Verizon Wireless, and T-Mobile, and so on. And the letter reads pretty clearly that, even though you put in net neutrality rules, these carriers are doing something that kind of skirts the intent of net neutrality, not actually the law, and you should modify what you're doing and change these rules. Hopefully that will happen. If you'd like to be aware of this space, the EFF has wonderful articles around this. In any case, let's go ahead and... Yeah.
In other AT&T news.
Okay.
Maybe we'll cover that after the break.
Yeah, we'll go on some more AT&T news, but please, we won't get all in AT&T. We'll also talk about Apple and what other fun things we'll talk about. Room temperature sensors?
Yes, but we'll talk about how AT&T wants to take your money, especially if you live in California.
We'll be right back. This is Geek Speak. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me is Mr. Miles Elam. We're talking about lots of things, but I want to let you know that you can always participate in the show. You can contact us on Twitter and Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks. That's KUSP Geeks. All one word. And of course, you can email us geeks@geekspeak.org. And you know, another thing that would be great, if you like the show, and of course you do because you're listening, please go ahead and rate us, rate our podcasts and such up on iTunes. Actually is the best way to share it. And of course, you can tell all your friends and such that we do this. We do this for free, don't we, Miles?
I'm not getting paid, are you?
I'm not getting paid. I lose money on this show. Mm. Yeah. All right, what do you got?
AT&T wants $100 million from California. And or at least their taxpayers.
And why wouldn't they want that? I want that too.
In exchange for giving a bunch of people DSL. Up to 10 megabits a second, 1 megabit a second.
Okay,
upload.
First off, that's not really great internet access. But AT&T is trying to get California to pay for them to increase the size of their network. Basically, carrying more DSL service to different locations.
Yeah.
DSL, of course, only works for like a mile and a half, 2 miles from the base station, wherever the phone company is. And AT&T, if there's an area of a place where people can't get DSL, it's because they don't have like a station, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so what they have to do is broaden that area. And of course, that's why AT&T has such a giant effect in the United States. It's because they used to be a conglomerate called AT&T. And they're financed basically by us. We all paid for the current infrastructure that they have by tax breaks.
In addition, the California Public Utilities Commission has a bottom limit to say that 1.5 megabits per second upload is a minimum acceptable speed to receive state subsidies under the California Advanced Services Fund.
That's pretty slow.
Yeah, they don't want to give that. They want to give 10 megabits per second down and 1 megabit per second up. So why? Less than 1.5.
Why do they want to bet that way? Because they think that people don't actually need 1.5 megabits up? Up and down, basically. When you're going up on the website and you download a video or watch a streaming service and stuff like that, that's downloading, right? And then if you're going to upload something, you put something on an FTP server or you send a giant attachment to somebody through email, that all counts against your up bandwidth. And up bandwidth is almost always slower than down bandwidth.
Right. And for residences, usage. That makes sense. At the same time, that really limits your choices if you want to exchange things with others. For example, if you ever do a peer-to-peer file sharing,
or online backups, a big thing. Online backups take a long time with these slow upload connections. And Miles and I always had to get our hardware for GeekSpeak in some physical facility instead of at our houses, even though our partners didn't want us to have noisy machines running all the time. Anyway, but now we do.
Yeah. So in other words, AT&T wants taxpayer money for a service that isn't actually considered acceptable for a state subsidy under normal circumstances. They just want a special carve out.
Can I just say boo? That doesn't sound good at all.
Yeah.
I don't think we should give it to them. Your thoughts?
I don't think so either. So you should talk to your, if you're in California, that is, talk to your state assembly member. It's Assembly Bill 2130. And by the way, it was written by AT&T lobbyists. Surprise!
And Chandler, of course, will put our intern Chandler will put a link up to that information on how to do that, assuming that he loves us as much as he should. Let's go ahead and talk about something that doesn't love us, and that is artificial intelligence.
Oh, Tay, why are you so cray?
I don't understand what you just said.
Tay is the artificial intelligence engine made by Microsoft that was put up on Twitter.
I heard wind of this. Microsoft, that's the company that made Windows, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so Twitter, of course, is that service that can't seem to make money even though they're worth billions of dollars. So Microsoft took their artificial intelligence. They gave it a Twitter handle, a Twitter account, mm-hmm. And what were the rules they gave forth for the bot?
Well, the bot was supposed to interact with people, answer their questions, maybe repeat things. And so a similar...
Like a tech support kind of thing?
No, as an interactive thing. They made it in the... They were aiming, anyway, for the personality of a teen girl.
Okay. So this was a way to kind of publicly showcase their artificial intelligence engine, but also to have like kind of a fun user experience.
Yes.
Do you remember Lisa, the early computer psychological program?
I don't.
Was it called Lisa? It wasn't called Lisa.
Lisa, I thought, was the Apple.
You're right. Lisa was the old Apple thing. Well, we'll find out what that was in a second. Okay, so Tay goes online and starts chatting as the context of a young female. I don't understand.
In China, there was an AI that was put online, and it actually had been doing well. It's been on since 2014. It's called Xiaolos. I don't speak Chinese. I have no idea how it's pronounced. But it's been going strong for a while. And so they figured, oh, I wonder what it would be like in the culture of, you know, the English-speaking world. Or Twitter, the Western world, I should say. Yeah, people started having her, figuring out that she would repeat stuff. You could get her to repeat stuff. And so she would repeat things.
Wait. How could you repeat them? You just tell her, hey, Tay, what does this mean? Or was it more like, say this?
Well, the bot is off now, so I don't know how you would interact with it. And many of the tweets have been deleted because they were extremely inflammatory. They started off saying, can I just say that I'm stoked to meet you? Humans are super cool. Less than 24 hours later, she was saying Hitler was right and going on from there.
Literally,
that's a quote.
Wait, how did that artificial... Wait, they programmed that artificial intelligence to do that? Or was it learning from the feedback it was getting from people?
Getting feedback from people. Because she didn't have any understanding about, for example, what the Holocaust was. She may have known the Holocaust was a proper noun, and so it should be capitalized. She may have known that it refers to an event, but doesn't know any of the historical context behind it or the pain or the significance of it in general discourse.
It's like a toddler with perfect communication skills with no concepts of meaning.
Sure.
Just kind of like reforming sentences nilly-willy.
Mm-hmm.
Or willy-nilly.
Yeah. So I hate feminists and they should all die and burn in hell.
Wait, how long did it take this artificial intelligence to get to this point?
Less than 24 hours, but 18 hours. Yeah.
No, the internet's horrible.
Yeah, chill, I'm a nice person. I just hate everybody. And then starts retweeting Donald Trump quotes. You know, we're going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. Oh, yeah.
Wait, was this how was this caused? This must have been caused by people feeding it.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely was.
Okay.
But the AI had no defense against that.
Have you ever heard of the gaming term TTP? I'll describe what that is in a minute. But the idea is if you give people a place to develop things and create things, there is a certain period of time called the time to penis. And basically it's until someone makes genitalia on the system. And the more flexibility and creativity you give them, of course, the sooner that occurs. And so this is just like that, right? How quickly can you make an artificial intelligence be vile? This is not good.
Is this like a conversation how long it takes before it turns into Nazi references or how long an argument or
And also isn't that basically corollaries that as soon as Nazi references happen the conversation is over? Eliza is this computer software I was thinking of, thanks to Greg, our support specialist from Canada, is a computer program and an early example of primitive natural language processing. Did you ever play with Eliza?
I did not.
It did things like When you typed in, the program would say, it'd say, hello, I'm your doctor, I'm helping you out. And you'd say, I've had this problem with that. And then it would say things like, you say like, my head hurts. And it says, why does your head hurt? So it would take words and then put a sentence around it that was a question. It was always asking a question. And it's actually kind of a fun thing to play with because it achieved the purpose of you to speak further, you know, keep on talking. Mm-hmm. It gave no context of why you'd be talking. Just kind of, that was a noun. I'll ask a question about it. Anyway, it sounds kind of like that aspect of it, except at the level of insults.
Right. And the reason why it went bad is because Twitter allows any of such thoughts to be freely available.
This is
the Chinese corollary, like you couldn't teach it about Tiananmen Square, that massacre, because the message would be deleted before there was any interaction there.
Thank God for that government.
Yeah, you have to say that for.
Do you have like opinions on like what Twitter could do to get rid of this problem they have with inflammatory, hateful speech?
I have mixed feelings about it. I do believe that they should still try to police it. They should still, you know, take in, you know, comments about there being abusive speech, mm-hmm. And abusive behavior towards others on there. But I'm also a believer in the fact that Twitter is a reflection of the people using it.
Yeah.
And
the internet.
Well, people. And it's people that are having these thoughts and then choosing to express them on Twitter.
Except for this case of this program of Microsoft's. Right. Yeah.
Well, but it's people that went to teach her
yeah.
Holocaust revisionism.
Well, so I guess what I'm saying, though, the question I'm asking is, right now Twitter has this amazing ability for a lot of information to be shared. I'm an early adopter of Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. I signed up. I actually have my first name, Lyle, on Twitter, if you want to follow me. And early on, it was just kind of interesting. And then I started following some people around programming and such, and it started to become this thing where when I hear something about JavaScript or the programming languages mm-hmm. I'm involved in, I'll repost them if they're interesting, or a seminar. And it's a very easy way to communicate at a light level around a topic area.
Yeah, it's kind of like a stream of information. I mean, not just how we talked about it there, but think of like water. There's little bits of everything mixing together, mm-hmm. and you don't have that long in-depth conversation about it. It's 140 characters, but you have this stream of new stuff that's going by that you can stop and like, you know,
dive into deeper. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember the first time I went, this is an amazing service. There was a fire in Santa Cruz, and I just chucked on Twitter with the hashtag, whatever the fire kind of had a common name. Mm-hmm. It was early when hashtags were first working. And very quickly, I saw pictures from where the road was being closed. And at that time, the fire department wasn't using it, but it was actually individuals that got stopped. And so you knew exactly where it was in my neighborhood. And therefore, I knew how close it was. I knew if it was close to a friend's house. I called them to see how they were. And it very quickly became a feature that we used at KOSP for news reporting. When that fire broke out, we were airing on KOSP about the fire because of people's on the ground reporting of it through Twitter. Mm-hmm. So it has this great ability. In natural disasters, it's been very helpful. But there's this aspect that this hate comes through. And yeah, I agree it's about the people that use it. But people, I mean, a lot of people
well,
suck.
Well,
right?
This is kind of like democracy. For example, a dictatorship is a lot more efficient.
Yeah, hey.
You know, fascism is
China.
A lot
China's
more efficient.
China's doing great with fascism, right? Get rid of that.
Well, they're not fascists, actually. They're the other way, but that's a whole other conversation. But that notion, though, is sometimes you have to take the bad with the good mm-hmm. Because democracy is messy. It means you have a whole bunch of people arguing different points, and some are more well-reasoned than others.
I get that, but there's got to be something that Twitter can do that makes it a better place for more people. I mean, right now, if you're a woman on Twitter speaking about gaming, you get hate mail.
Yes.
Horrible stuff going on. There's got to be a way to some degree help alleviate that. Why aren't they doing it?
But as I said, I think that Twitter is more of a symptom than a cause. So if you try to address it on Twitter, you're either going to be ineffectual or you're going to have some technical solution that overplays its hand and suddenly it's not as
useful. I'm talking about Twitter making it such that they could do things of this nature. I don't know if they should do this thing, but they could associate every account with a working phone number. Right, so you have to have a mobile phone with text support, and it has to be unique to have a Twitter handle. And therefore, if you want a Twitter handle, you got to be associated with a phone number. So if you start doing a lot of hate speech and a lot of people start blocking you, you downgrade your ability to be on there. It's basically making it non-anonymous. I mean, what would be wrong with doing that? Do you think that Twitter has to have an anonymous capability? I personally feel like maybe we reduce that a little bit to make it so that there's more equity in speech.
Twitter operates in more than one country.
Sure.
And one of the things about Twitter that makes it so powerful is that there is anonymity for example, political dissidents to be able to voice their opinions without being found. Now, if Twitter were operating in that country, because the country could also have the option of blocking them. If they were in that country, then you also lend the, you take away that anonymity.
Yeah.
That may take away one of the strongest forces for political action that Twitter has made available. So I don't.
So another aspect of this, though, and I agree that silencing a voice that because they can't, they need to have an anonymity is one thing. But at the same time, if you said, well, you have accounts that are that there's two different kinds of accounts. There's anonymous accounts and there's non-anonymous accounts. And an individual can receive and hear messages based off of that. You'd still have those people have voices. There'd still be people that listened to them and maybe retweeted them because they weren't in that same country. But you'd at least have a barrier to anybody being anonymous, meaning that you'd have some level of dissection between what was anonymous and therefore potentially the person needs to be protected and what is an actual person that has less anonymity.
And what happens...
Seems like that would help.
Yes. And I do agree that... For example, Twitter can be toxic for for large segments of society. At the same time, what we consider important is not necessarily what other people consider important, and is not what other countries and their cultures consider important. And their restrictions, their firewalls, you know, are going to be different, and in some ways, seemingly hateful to us.
Sure.
That's the hard thing. That's why I talk about in terms of a technical solution. There are things that they can do. There is policing they can do, but it's not. I don't believe there is a silver bullet. I don't think that there is anything that can really fix that problem. I think we do need to fix the underlying problems in society.
I agree. The fixing that would be great. I don't think that we're actually going to make humanity everybody better.
I agree.
I would like to make a place, a safe space for people to be able to, you know, have the kind of liberty that I have on Twitter, because I don't get attacked like that. Like, I want everyone to have that ability. And if that means that we have to have, like, a way of limiting to some degree who can be on there, or at least kind of filtering at some level so you're aware of who is anonymous and who is not, it seems like a pretty good trade-off. Now, Jack Dorsey, who's actually currently came back online as the CEO of Twitter, of course, is Jack on Twitter. That's his handle. But Jack just recently tweeted or retweeted somebody talking about the U.S. government's stopping the request for Apple to unlock the phone. Now, this is a story we've mm-hmm. talked about for a while. FBI and Apple have been kind of debating back and forth. And we're going to talk more about that in just a minute. You're listening to Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Mr. Miles Elam. So Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, just retweeted it's really funny that he's retweeted this. So one of the things that Twitter has famously done is they limit their characters to 140 characters. And the reason they did that is early on, the interaction with Twitter was through text messaging. And so you could text a full tweet by putting 140 characters, and that actually worked for most phones. And now, of course, people use apps and that feed doesn't matter at all. But one of the tweets that he's requoted is an image of the story that I'm about to read. And the things that people do all the time is take pictures of text and then put that picture in there so that they can express more text. But here's the thing about the iPhone or Apple case regarding Farouk's, the terrorist who I think he killed himself, but basically shot a lot of people, and his phone the government wanted to access, and Apple was saying, no, we're not going to help you. So they responded, basically, they've told the court that they do not need the phone to be cracked by Apple anymore. They say, the government has now successfully accessed the data stored on Farouk's iPhone and therefore no longer requires assistance from Apple Inc., mandated by court's order compelling Apple Inc. to assist agents in search, dated February 16, 2016. So they're saying that they accessed the phone. This means, of course, that the FBI has either did get help and accessed the phone, something that we thought you really couldn't do, or they're lying about it. We don't really know. But it's very likely that there's a way that somebody was able to crack it. The FBI, though, isn't telling Apple how.
Right. Then isn't telling anyone how.
Why not?
From the FBI's point of view, it's an ongoing investigation. Then again, the person that they would be investigating is dead. But it, I guess the rationale would also be it's a investigation on any related terror cells. If at the same time, the cynical person in me might say, if they had found something, then they would be very vocal about it.
Because they'd be able to point the finger at Appleseed, say, see, you didn't help us. But of course, if they found something, it might be, I mean, what they're claiming is that it could be they find other people that this person's been associated with.
Right.
Right. That's, and they, of course, they wouldn't. Like I said,
the cynical part of me.
That.
So the non-cynical part of me says, no, they're trying to.
But the cynical part of me is that they didn't crack it. Like, one of the ideas here is that the FBI was trying to use this case as a way of getting Apple to do something that then later we could, they could base other cases against, mm-hmm. and other law enforcement could ask Apple to do this again. And therefore, if they are not achieving that goal, and it looked like from public opinion, Apple wasn't rolling over, and in general, the debate had become very public and not exactly in favor of the FBI's stance. Mm-hmm. Because of that, the FBI just said, no, never mind, we did it ourselves. We don't know if that's true or not.
Well, I don't know if they did it themselves per se. I think they got help. Someone else contacted them and said,
I guess what I'm saying is it's possible that they didn't get access to it at all.
It's possible, but I don't think that's likely. I think they did get access to it. But another little wrinkle to this is, whereas the FBI was saying, Apple, you need to give us this information, do this thing, now we're in the position where Apple is looking to the FBI saying, hey, how did you do that? Because for them, there's a security flaw in their device.
Interesting. Well, that's
right. But unlikely that the FBI would tell them how. But it's a test for the disclosure policy for a governmental organization.
So, the Google and Facebook and lots of other companies offer hackers these bounties. They actually have events and they sponsor mm-hmm. people cracking into their software. And an example of this, this happens all the time, but in general, the idea is we're going to put up $100,000. If you can find a vulnerability.
That's a lot for them. Usually they're smaller.
But that has happened. $100,000 has happened. And let's say they're $10,000. So we're looking for a vulnerability to what's called a zero-day export. No one's ever seen this exploit before, but basically it allows maybe someone to access a web page with the Chrome browser, and the person that accesses it could get infected by a virus. That would be a serious vulnerability that Google would want to know about. So Google puts up this bounties for like $10,000 for these kind of vulnerabilities. And then they pay the person discloses it. If it succeeds, the person gets paid and they fix it before they publish how it happened.
Right.
Right? It's a great way of getting a lot of people spending a lot of time hacking at stuff.
Right.
And Google does this, and a lot of companies do this. Apple notoriously does not do this. Did you know that?
Yes, I did know that.
Why don't they do it?
Well, Apple has always been more secretive in their development process. That's for one. But there are a lot of people that are saying that, Apple, you need to get on board, especially because this is, this is a public-facing piece of software, web browser, operating system, stuff like that. So it goes, Apple in general hasn't done it. Facebook and Google have. Yep. And
the thing that's interesting about the Apple not doing this is that, of course, there's going to be people that spend time finding vulnerabilities in software. And then there's other people that actually want access to vulnerabilities. The FBI, for example, wanted access to be able to break into this mm-hmm. phone. Money is exchanged on the black market for this. And because Apple hasn't participated in this at all, there's actually a larger black market and more organized black market around Apple vulnerabilities. And some reports have said that as much as $1 million for an Apple vulnerability. $100,000 one was offered pseudo-publicly for an iOS 9 breach capability. So there is a lot of money being passed around to get into these devices. So it's interesting that somebody went up to FBI and said, we could do this. I wonder if they said to the FBI, and you have to pay us. Because, of course, the FBI has some pockets. I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting. Should we go on about cool. What is this, transmitting of data story you got?
Yes. How fast is your internet connection?
You know what? I'll do a test right now. But, it's something like...
How much do you pay for?
I don't know. I don't keep track of that, really.
Sorry. I pay for a 50 megabit connection myself.
Yeah, I guess that's the one I've got, too. Kind of like a higher-end level Comcast.
Yeah, it's like 50, 15. Mm-hmm. 50 down, 15 up. Well, some engineers at the University of Illinois have been pushing the limits. Now, back in 2014, that same group was able to achieve 40 gigabits per second over a fiber line.
That is a lot of data.
At room temperature. So none of this, cooling everything down. Oh, okay, so, yeah. None of this, putting in liquid helium.
So 1,024 times more, faster than yours.
Yes.
Comparable.
And this time, they've transmitted 57 gigabits per second. Now, other people have transmitted faster than that, but what makes this one different is that it transmitted at that speed error-free.
Is that rare?
Yeah, I mean, you can push data to go much faster. Think about when you're trying to speak quickly. You can speak quickly up to a certain point, and there are people that can speak very quickly, but after a certain point, if you try to push a little bit further, you become unintelligible.
Yes.
You start fumbling over your tongue.
I run into that all the time.
And that's the type of thing. Like, you can go a little bit faster, but then things get garbled.
I see. So when you're pushing the limit of the broadband, if you will, you have to account for errors, because the more errors you have, actually, effectively, the less data transfer you're
having. Right, because then you have to stop. The other side has to say, hey, I didn't get that. You need to retransmit. So being able to send that much error-free is a wonderful achievement. And I highly respect the grad students Curtis Wang and Michael Liu and their professor Milton Feng.
Very cool. And this, of course, is not – this is just a science-y kind of thing.
This is in the lab.
Practically. By the way, I did a test right that while we were talking, 18.4 megabits down and 7.3 megabits up. So not nearly as fast as what you have as a service. Maybe I should look up how much I pay for. Anyway, if you're interested in what your speed is or your ISP's potential speed is, you can do a search for speed test, and you'll find a whole bunch of them online. You can run them, and that gives an idea of how fast it is. The company I work for, a little video
which service, is a shame. Side note, yeah. Many ISPs, or at least the large ISPs, actually know where the speed tests are, and they will optimize some traffic.
That is
way.
A bit of a problem. Yeah.
But so anyway.
So another way to do this is to use what we call I work for Netflix, and we actually publish this thing called the ISP Speed Index. And we know where the traffic is coming from all the users, and we're like, at peak, we're up to a third of the internet traffic in the United States. So we do a lot of data transfer.
Data hogs.
So you, as you know, the consumers of the Netflix service are connecting from all these different ISPs, and we know which ISP it's connected to. So we actually keep a record of what the speed connections are per user, and we publish that publicly. So if you want to know how good your ISP is, so I'm going to enter a country code, USA here, because that's where I'm right now. So it's ISP Speed Index, and it looks like the best service in the United States, the top ranked ISP is Fios, Verizon Fios, which of course is fiber to people's houses, so of course it is. And yeah, so anyway, you can take a look at this thing and see what kind of speed people actually get.
Yeah, I think they offer a 2 gigabit line or something like that. You have to pay $1,000 a month or $500 a month, or I forgot what it was. Yeah. Something beyond most residences.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you have it, woohoo!
Now, most people in the United States actually have one option. So there is that. It can kind of be depressing that you might not get anything useful. Should we talk a little about Saturn?
Sure. You want to talk about it?
Yeah. Sure. Why not, right? How old do you think when do you think our moon was formed? You know, Miles, of course, the Earth and moon used to be one collision thing, and we got hit by something the size of Mars.
Yes.
And it split up into two different bodies.
Right.
And you know about how long ago that happened?
I believe that was something along the lines of, 4 billion years ago? It was
Yeah, that's right. So our solar system is about 4.5 billion years.
Yeah, the Earth was less than a billion years old.
Yeah, and, I mean, yeah. And the whole idea of what the durations are, coalescence, if you will, mm-hmm. of the planets happened about 4.5 billion years ago. About 100 million
4.7, yeah.
Yeah, about 100 million years after it happened. Not very long ago, not very long after, the Earth got split apart into the moon and the Earth.
Okay, so it's closer to 4.5 billion years, yeah, now, not 4 billion.
Long time ago.
It's kind of a difference, 4 billion to 4.5 billion.
We're talking about a billion years, whatever. In any case, a recent study came out, a new paper published this week from Astrophysics Journal, authored by scientists from SETI, which is a search for, SETI? Search for
Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Thank you. Institute and the Southwest Research Institute found that actually some of Saturn's moons may be as young as 100 million years. so very recently. So Saturn's moons, of course, Saturn is famous for its giant ring, but it actually has a lot of moons also in the orbit. And you can tell it's a moon because it's big enough and it's cleared its orbital path, if you will. So the ring has stridations in it, and some of those
rings
have stridations. Well, I was going to say the ring mass is striated, and then it becomes rings. You get what I'm saying? Anyway, those holes in the ring
you go with it, man.
Are moons, and some of those are quite young. It's pretty cool. Saturn currently has about 62 moons, so we're talking a lot of them. Anyway, it's really kind of cool. And they did this all by looking at orbital mechanics, and they just inspected the actual orbital complications, if you will, of having a system of this nature, looked at what they had, and figured out that the resonance pattern of the orbit and of the rings denoted a duration of like 100 million years, which is really neat that it's that young. So it's still producing moons.
Means that dinosaurs were around when the rings were formed before, and when the dinosaurs first arrived on planet Earth, there were no rings of Saturn.
No moons of Saturn.
And no rings.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't understand that aspect of it.
The moons and the rings. Because the rings were formed probably from the breakup of a moon.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Gotcha. All right. Did you read up on the USB virus?
No, I didn't.
Oh, man. This thing's kind of creepy. You know about like being infected by an email attachment, something like that, right? You get a part of an application and it installs itself on your machine, and we call that a virus because it kind of spreads by itself. There's different types.
Okay.
The way we fight these normally is we have antivirus software on our computers that recognize the signatures of the incoming payloads, and you detect them and therefore eliminate them. Mm-hmm. Very much like our biological systems.
Yes. Well, I mean, our immune system looks for the signatures and also the behavior, but yeah.
Right. I mean, what happens when you actually get a cold, the reason why you get over a cold, if you do, hopefully, is that your body actually is able to produce antibodies that attack that virus. And it takes a little time to do it, and that's why you get sick for a while. And the way our computer systems are doing that, the metaphor works pretty well. We write software, a whole bunch of companies write software, they look for the signature that represents a virus, a computer virus, and they basically delete that virus or modify it and try to get rid of it. So one way that people have worked to hide their viruses is to modify their code. And it's challenging to do because algorithmically you can kind of inspect it and reverse engineer it and figure out again what kind of code it is. So there's a war game, if you will, of companies trying to detect viruses and other people trying to create viruses. A new virus that's come out and kind of become popular, or I shouldn't say popular, but well-known, is a USB virus. So it's a malware that goes on to a USB stick. And when you install it and you stick the stick in your computer, it can run a bit of code and infect your machine. And the way this software is doing this is it's using the ID of the USB key, if you will, to encrypt the data on it, and has multiple levels of encryption so that it's extremely hard to detect it, meaning that it's difficult to get a signature on it to actually ever see it again. So you can get infected, and even though that's been infected and we've seen it, it's hard then to write software that will detect it again. In addition, it's self-protecting, the multi-stage thing, is pretty simple, but it's really good at hiding itself. And it's kind of a new era, if you will. And after the USB is removed, nobody can find out the data was stolen. So this virus basically goes across your machine, steals data, pulls it off your computer, and then pulling it off, there's no sign of that virus again on your machine. So once the USB stick's gone, no good. Miles, I remember you and I were working, doing something at KOSP, we're doing a show, and I wanted to show you a video I had on a USB thumb drive. And I went to put it on your computer, and you blocked me from putting it on your computer with your hand. It was a Google computer, mm-hmm. And I was like, dude, why is this the paranoia? And you very clearly were talking about this kind of thing, weren't you?
Yeah. And in fact, there have been reports since then about Thunderbolt attacks on a Mac. You know, being able to
It has memory access.
The port used on Macs and a few other PC devices to connect up to monitors and other high-speed peripherals.
Yeah. Hey, in a minute, Miles is going to tell us a bit about a Japanese artificial intelligence that did something kind of cool. A GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff, reuse our stuff, do anything you like with it. All you have to do is let them know we said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9, KOSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. Of course, you can email us. We're geeks at geekspeak.org. Or you can participate publicly on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KOSP Geeks. Our intern is Chandler. Thank you so much, Chandler, for making the GeekSpeak website work so well. And to our support expert from the north, Greg Merkley, thank you so much for naming and titling the show well during the show with this pesky little research project. Thank you to Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song.
One thing that we worry about is computers taking our jobs.
Absolutely.
We worry about it with fast food workers, you know, that robots will just take
over.
Drivers. Some people are even worried about programmers. Like a lot of programmers, you just need to keep upping your skills because the basic stuff's just being handled.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you don't worry about is an author, you know, writing fiction. Well,
right.
A Japanese AI wrote a wrote a novel or a short story known as titled "The Day a Computer Writes a Novel."
Oh, awesome.
And while it didn't win first prize, it did pass the first round of screening, and it's the national literary prize.
So it was a relatively good short story.
Good
awesome.
Enough.
Miles Elam, thanks for joining me today on Geek Speak, and thank you
Always
all.
A pleasure.
And thank you all for participating on episode 13 of our 16th season. We'll see you next week.